unlikely case that anyone's listening who's never heard the method, you quickly have to go through.
What the method is, sure. Anything that's potentially meaningful, you can't finish the moment you think of it. You better capture it in some sort of trusted bucket externally. Sooner than later, you better decide exactly what it means to you. Is it actionable, yes or no? And if it is, decide what's the very next action I would need to take to move the needle on it. And if one action won't finish it, what's the project or the outcome I'm committed to complete that I need to keep track of until it's done? And then I need to organize the results of that in some sort of trusted system that I then can reflect and review what the contents are from the gestalt period with a clear head, and then make good trusted choices about what I do and what I don't do.
Perfect.
That's it.
So let's do it. Let's get fixed. No.
That is it.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
sorry. I'm not going to tell you anything other than what I just told you.
But why is the book so long?
I needed to create a filter to find out the people who were really going to get it.
Gleich geht's los mit On the Way to New Work. Es kommt hier wieder die ganz kurze Einordnung. Ihr wisst, wir befinden uns in einer sehr besonderen Situation derzeit. Die Folge, die ihr gleich hört, ist unsere Jubiläumsfolge. Sie soll deswegen nicht untergehen. Wir haben mit David Allen kurz bevor die Corona-Krise hier in Deutschland angekommen ist, gesprochen. Und wirklich ein gutes Gespräch geführt in Berlin im Soho-Haus als Live-Podcast. Und wir hoffen, dass ihr in den Zeiten heute trotzdem euch die Zeit nehmt, reinzuhören. Es ist viel Gutes da drin. Man kann gerade jetzt die Zeit nutzen, wenn man eben zu Hause sitzt, sich neu zu organisieren. David Allen ist der Erfinder der Methode Getting Things Done, GTD. Insofern lohnt es sich sehr, reinzuhören. Da uns aber auch die aktuelle Situation sehr betrifft und Michael und ich uns gedacht haben, wir möchten unseren Beitrag leisten, unser Wissen teilen, die Kontakte teilen und auch von meinem Unternehmen, von Blackboard, die Kompetenz teilen, was Cloudwork, Homeoffice und so weiter betrifft, haben wir einen Livestream gestartet, den wir Montag bis Freitag jeden Tag als Live-Sendung auf YouTube laufen haben, immer ab 11 Uhr morgens, also perfekt, wenn man eine kurze Pause machen möchte über den Tag, einfach mal reinhören. Man kann einfach mitlaufen lassen. Wir holen Experten rein, reden zum Thema, schauen auf die Frage, wie kann man den Laden am Laufen halten. Das Ganze findet ihr in meinem YouTube-Kanal, youtube.com/Christoph Magnussen. Michael sitzt in seinem Remote-Work-Office, ich bei mir. Und wir schalten uns zusammen in gewohnter Manier, aber eben mit der Idee, den Laden am Laufen zu halten. Also, viel Spaß beim Zuschauen und jetzt viel Spaß mit On the Way to New Work.
Welcome to a very special On the Way to New Work podcast episode. It's the episode number 200. And for me, it's a great pleasure to introduce to you tonight Michael Trautmann and Christoph Magnussen. For me, already the best podcast duo in Germany. Oh, no doubt about that.
Yeah. That is so nice.
And with the team from Next Action, I'm really so proud that we are the host of the Jubilee edition here tonight with a very special guest. You will know later who will be that. And I started listening to that podcast after December 3rd, when I met Michael Trautmann first. He was guest in my seminar, and then he came after the seminar and said, "This day changed my life. We have to talk." I said, "Yeah, we can talk." He said, "No, not here in my podcast." I said, "Okay." So I come to Hamburg and we can...
He never told me that.
Okay. Yeah.
But it's okay.
It's okay. Okay. So and then I came to Hamburg and said, "Yeah, let's discuss what could be the idea for the podcast." I said, no idea. I have a studio here at the Podstars. Let's go. And we have 2 hours in total. So don't waste time. And
get things done.
And what he really managed, and as well Christoph, and you listen to the podcast, is that they are very warm-hearted people who create an atmosphere in their podcast which opens everything for the people who get interviewed. I talked to Katja earlier. We have been, each of us, a guest at the podcast. And we were like, yeah, they did it away. Like, you were ready to answer everything. And that will be very important also for tonight. Michael Trautmann is a person who is an entrepreneur. He's one of the stars of the advertising scene. He has been the Audi brand chef, and he is founder of Think with a J. And this sports company, I really like that. It's Hyrox. But much more important is the attitude, how he faces people and how he does the dialogues and the speech and all that thing. So I really had a great energy from talking and working with Michael so far.
Thank you so much.
Christoph, I met first today, a successful entrepreneur, and we have one thing in common. And I think he longer than I am, he's a great GTD fan for years. And he read that book during his university studies in St. Gallen, I heard earlier. And this guy's created something 3 years ago on the way to new work. And they had various guests like Christiane zu Salm, who was the MTV Europe chef as a female leader in that days. And a companion for the dying, so really very sensitive talks. And in episode number 100, it was Fridtjof Bergman, the founder of the New Work movement. And we thought that it would be a great introduction to watch to a short video in a couple of minutes to get an idea of what these guys are doing. And for episode number 200, they asked whether we can get David in the house. So we got him in the house, in the Soho house, and I'm very grateful to welcome you, Catherine. Yeah, behind every successful man, there is an even more successful woman. Catherine and David Allen, welcome to that small group. It doesn't make any sense to give some background to David Allen, because that will be part of the night in the podcast. I can only tell you that I got introduced to David with my partner 7 years ago when we started that business for getting things done. We started it as a business and we continue it as a movement. And I'm very happy that you are a guest with these two fabulous guys in the podcast on the way to new work in episode 200. So have fun, and we are ready to listen. And I will move to my chair. We will watch the video and then the stage is yours, guys. Perfect. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
And also for you.
Afterwards.
Yeah. Perfect. And we will have the opportunity for questions after the episode. Dankeschön.
Guten Morgen.
Guten Morgen. Guten Morgen.
Hallo, Michael.
Schön, dich zu sehen. Freude.
Ist ja wunderbar. Wir treffen uns, wenn ihr mir die Gelegenheit gibt, zu beschreiben, was ich versuche, dann.
Das wollen wir.
Herzlich willkommen zum On the Way to New Work Podcast, Folge 100. Michael und ich, Christoph, sitzen in Ann Arbor bei Fridtjof Bergman.
Ja, und der Fridtjof Bergman ist ganz glücklich, dass ihr bei ihm seid. Aber dagegen ist es eben wieder einer dieser Punkte, wo ich mich gewehrt habe. Gesagt habe, ich glaube, die Arbeit ist ein interessantes Thema und kann also ein sehr interessantes Thema werden in der Zukunft. Das ist etwas, wo ich gewissermaßen recht hatte. Jetzt bin ich 88 Jahre alt und ich habe das Gefühl, nein, es war nicht ein Fehler. Es ist geglückt, trotzdem ich jetzt 88 bin. Also das etwas zu tun, das einem Angst macht. Und eben zu sagen, okay, mach Angst. Schön, gut, darf dich nicht besonders beeindrucken. Für mich ist der Gedanke, dass etwas einem Angst macht, macht mir keine Angst. In entscheidend ist, dass wir jetzt die technologischen Möglichkeiten haben. Wir haben jetzt die Technologie entwickelt, die es uns möglich macht, Arbeit völlig anders aufzubauen, zu denken, zu organisieren als bisher. Arbeit kann wirklich das sein, was den Menschen stärkt, anstatt ihn schwächt. Das ist im Grunde genommen einer der Hauptgründe, warum ich ganz einfach gesagt so sehr dankbar bin, dass ihr jetzt hier seid. Weil das ist jetzt die Gelegenheit, das dazu zu bringen, dass der Modebegriff neue Arbeit mit dem Gegenteil von dem konfrontiert wird. Und dass etwas ganz anderes wirklich die Absicht von allem Anfang an war. Wie sieht die Welt aus, die wir wollen? Jetzt hängt es von uns ab.
This warm introduction, thank you very much, and the over-promising, we now try to not fall down so much, but I think David will help us with this. So we are so proud, so happy to have you here in Berlin, and we always start our podcast with one question. It's the question, how did you become the person you are today? You can decide whether to answer it in 5 or in 15 sentences or 10 minutes, whatever you like.
What comes to mind is I followed the still small voice inside of me that said, you know, it's time to do this. I go, really? Oh God, do that? Yes, do that. And that still small voice, learning who that voice is, how it is, how to access it, is still part of my game, still how I operate. So it's kind of one foot in front of the other and taking advantage of opportunities as they showed up.
Very good question, but we will have to ask you a little bit deeper. What was the first that this voice told you, what you remember?
What comes to mind is my first job, age 5, magician on the sidewalk in Palestine, Texas, charging 5 cents to have kids watch me do magic tricks. Like, how can I do that? So, you know, by age 35, 35 jobs later, there was all those kinds of changes and all those kinds of things going on. So I didn't really realize I had a master plan. I kind of had an inkling of it. In retrospect, you know, given the work that I do, I've always been interested in models. I've always been interested actually in the relationship between the invisible and the visible. And so I couldn't have told you back then, but in retrospect, all of the things I decided to do were things that explored how do we make this world work? Because I think there's something bigger than what we see and feel in this world that's running this world or having an awful lot to do with it. And I said, I am also, guys, the laziest guy you have ever met. No, that's the truth. I'll stand toe-to-toe with anybody on that. So I said, if I can figure out how this thing operates that we can't see, that's affecting all the stuff we can see, wow, wouldn't that be cool? I could get stuff to move with just thinking about it and not having to get up and make it move. So wouldn't that be cool? So that sort of interested me in magic, interested me in all kinds of things. You know, I became a philosophy major in college to try to figure out God, truth, and the universe. got bored by the philosophers because they wound up proving their original hypothesis using their original hypothesis. I thought, well, that's kind of a circle. But what was more interesting were the philosophers themselves. Why they thought that way. Why did Kant think the way he thought? Why did... I wound up getting very interested in something we didn't call it back then, paradigms, but how paradigms affected perception, performance, behavior, and all of that. So I became an intellectual history major. You know, history of thought, history of culture, history of not political or military history so much, but why people wrote the way they wrote, why mathematics showed up that way at the same time, and so forth. So I got very fascinated with all that stuff, and wound up as an American intellectual history major, Berkeley, 1968. So there was a time to explore lots of different things that you couldn't see. And, you know, so it was a big exploration journey about all of that. So I wound up, instead of studying people who were enlightened, decided I wanted my own. So I figured graduate school wasn't where I was going to find it, so I dropped out. Meditation, spiritual practices, explorations of all sorts, got a black belt in the martial arts, all kinds of things, more to explore me. So I was more interested in me than the material world. Who am I? What am I? What is this thing? How do I make this operate? So that was a lot of what my driver was. But again, I was not, rice bowl and cave was not my style. I liked, you know, good looking women and Chardonnay and, you know, things like that. So I said, well, but they're not paying people to go find themselves, you know, so I had to maintain jobs. So I actually became a very good number two guy. So I had friends who actually in my network who seemed to know what they wanted to do. They were building their own businesses and so forth. So I wound up being a good number two guy. Helped a lot of them start their businesses, run their businesses and so forth. Of course, I just show up and go, how much easier could we do this? Now they call that process improvement, right? I just called it lazy. Come on, what can we do? And so I walked in and helped these people do the kind of structure their business and get it more organized so it worked a lot easier. And then I'd get bored. So I'd quit and go find another job. Then I discovered they call those people something and they pay them to do that. Consultant, right? So now I are one. You know, 1981, hung out my shingle, Allen Associates. So that was much more than what you ask about, but that's, you know, that kind of sort of triggered me to run down my path. So there was no big strategic, wow, here's what I'm going to do with my life. I had no idea what I was going to do with my life. You know, I was always jealous of people who seemed to know what they wanted to do with their lives. And so I just kept banging around until I got, you know, wound up in a situation where I said, wow, I'm now out there as a consultant. What do I do? And that's where a lot of what my research that ultimately came into and became Getting Things Done in GTD and the methodology that I put together.
When was that?
1981, 82.
That far back. I mean, I'm born in 82, so that's...
Well, hey guys, I turned 75 this year, so...
We can't see this.
You know, so yeah, it was a while ago.
But between 81 and 201, there are 20 years. So 20 years of consulting practice. And when was it exactly where you say, well, I have to write down a method. I have to write this book. I have to put all my things into a system.
Yeah.
Was it 2001?
Good question. No, it was actually 1996. As I say, it took me 25 years to actually figure out what I'd figured out, that it was unique, that nobody else had figured it out, and that it was bulletproof. You couldn't poke a hole in it. I figured out this methodology for myself first because I got so attracted to empty space in my head. I loved that from the martial arts, from meditation or whatever, discovered what I now refer to as the strategic value of clear space. If you're present, have nothing on your mind, you're much more capable of being strategic, smart, intelligent, not over and under reacting to anything. You're most productive. It's the best state to hit a golf ball from or cook spaghetti from or have a difficult conversation from. When you're clear. So I had an attraction to clarity, to clear. I'm also kind of a freedom guy. I hate being constrained by stuff that, you know, kind of wraps me around its axle. No.
Can it be that Christoph is your son? That's what you thinking
I,
right now.
I know we're not supposed to talk too much, well, but
I have one. I had a lot of girlfriends, so I don't know.
Okay, Kevin, we can cut this out. If you don't want it, we can cut it out.
One story I have to share with Michael, I never shared. Michael and I met as business partners. And Michael, I share this now. I know, I never shared this. And I did the training back then for him on the emails. And I was using GTD on the email training because when I read your book, you got me on the point with the empty space and to collect. I always loved stuff where I could collect everything because then it was, for me, gone. Michael's email inbox had 39,500 something emails.
And you're kidding.
I was sitting in front of the screen. I'm like, what are you doing? Like, yeah, I try to organize it a certain day. And I said, you know what?
He's lying.
I give you the labels from GTD and then we archive everything. And Michael just, like, when I explained him the method, he just marked everything, literally everything, and then threw it all away, but also his note labels. So all his notes were gone, but they were just way back in the archive. That was the first day we came together.
Yeah.
And that was based on the GTD. Well,
you know, we call it email bankruptcy.
Yeah, exactly.
Basically it's control A, control X, and pray.
Yeah, right? Oh, we did. And he didn't get a heart attack, so he's still alive.
Yeah, good.
Fine.
You're doing all right.
Yeah.
Yay. Good for you. So I was attracted to clear space, so I discovered a lot of these techniques for myself. I did not wake up one morning with some grand epiphany. You know, believe me, this methodology is a long string of epiphanets.
I hoped you did.
You know,
I
was like, well, I had a good mentor who taught me two of the basics of it, because he had developed, speaking of new work, he had developed a fascinating model for organizational change as an executive consultant for years. He'd been in the game for 25 years or so.
Who was it?
Dean Acheson. And Dean took me under his wing and said, how about we do some projects together? Because I think you're probably going to take this further than I have. And Dean had discovered that in order for an organization to make change and to shift, you got to get the barnacles off the ship. And that there was a whole lot of old business and old spin and old open loops sitting in people's heads, sitting in the offices, sitting in the desks, sitting everywhere, that made it very difficult for people to try to change because all that old business was still hanging onto them like barnacles. So he discovered, just as a very first process to sort of clear the deck so that they could start to make the change, was sit down with the CEO first and then empty their head, have them decide next actions on everything they got out of their head, and then rapidly run down to all their direct reports, because all of a sudden all kinds of stuff, you know, because constipation actually happens uphill, not down. And so he started to unstick a lot of stuff. It turned out that just that initial process solved 90% of the presenting issues. Because all you had to do was to surface what's got people's attention, have them make a decision about what they need to do about it, and oh my God, stuff happens. So he did that with me, and I wasn't out of control. I thought I had my life kind of together. And he had me do a data core dump out of my head and make a next action decision about everything. I'm like, holy, oh my God, I noticed what happened to me. And so I began to work with that myself, turned around with my own consulting clients and used those techniques, and it turned out it produced exactly the same results as it did for me. More clarity, more focus, more space, more control, more of a sense of ability to be free to think about meaningful stuff, you know, in a cool way. So that became, I started to build this sort of set of methodologies around just for myself, because my life was getting more complex, and as it gets more complex, it was kind of pretty easy to screw up clear space. So I said, how do I get back to clear space? And now I have 16 or 75 projects. How do I do that? And so I got hungry for myself for these things. And then as I applied them, turned around, they worked. Then a guy, head of human resources for Lockheed, saw what I was doing. He said, God, we need that in our whole culture. Can you design a training program around what you've come up with so we could reach a lot of people with this methodology, not just one at a time? So I worked for a couple of months and designed a personal productivity training. We did a pilot program for 1,000 executives and managers at Lockheed, 1983-84, and it worked. And I found myself thrust into the corporate training world. As an intellectual history major in Berkeley in 68, if you'd have told me that, I'd said, what are you smoking? Are you kidding? You know, come on. But it turned out that was the hungriest market for what I had come up with. Mm. And so then, fast forward 25 years training hundreds of thousands of people and coaching. My consulting really turned more into coaching. We didn't call it then, but it was just one-on-one work with executives and senior people in these organizations that wanted hands-on for me to work with them desk side to get them to get the to get it. And so essentially I have, you know, Gladwell talks about 10,000 hours. I have probably spent 60,000 hours, literally, desk side, one-on-one with some of the busiest, best and brightest people on the planet, actually, you know, both formulating and then implementing and refining this methodology, you know, there. So that's why I say it took me that long to kind of figure out that nobody else had figured out. Guys, I've never had a traditional formal class in business, psychology, or time management. This is streets. You know, I'm just from the streets. That's all this was. Maybe that's the good news, because I had no preconditioning about what all that should be or what it should look like. So this just started to work. And then to answer your question specifically, I bought out a couple of partners. We weren't able to sort of market this thing or sell it the way I thought it could be done. I wanted to keep the flame lit in terms of this methodology. And at that point, this was 1995, Catherine, 94, 95, something like that. I brought together about 7 or 8 or 9 friends of mine that were business people and sharp folks. And I said, rake me over the coals, guys. So we, you know, spent a day in a hotel. And I said, look, what do I do? They said, write the book. Write the book.
Yeah.
So talk about stepping off the end of the pier and not knowing how deep or how shallow the water is. You know, that was a big one. So that was 1997. It took 4 years from the time I pulled the trigger to write the book to actually get it on the shelf. And that was a pretty agonizing 4 years, because I was doing a day and a half job all day and then trying to convince myself that after a breakfast meeting with a client and a stand-up all-day seminar and, you know, drinks with clients in the afternoon and then be on a plane for 2 hours thinking I was going to write the next chapter. It was like, who are you kidding? You know, it's so funny. I mean, Catherine could tell you, I almost became an alcoholic writing a book about stress-free productivity. Yeah. Oh, my God, what do I do? So it took a while, because I was putting my whole life work of 25 years that I come to, and it's not an easy book to read.
Thank you. It is not easy to read. But
well,
it is.
It's not really. Yeah, I mean, yeah. I didn't write it as a training manual.
You think? I mean, I remember. As I said, the page when you got me was the collection part. When I said, okay, I get a sense of it because, like, clean desk, clean mind. I totally got a sense from it, and that's when you got me. And then I was like, okay, give me the method. And what I figured then, and I don't know when this hype started online, but what I loved about it, I could use different colors, stickers, markers, books, paint. So all the creative heart could go into this process. It was the first time I could work on the work itself. I love that.
Yeah. Well, most people just work. They don't realize that work is an art. And the art of work is like, you know, the late, great Peter Drucker said, biggest challenge for knowledge workers, and that's pretty much everybody in the world these days. Anybody's got to think to decide what to do or how to deal with an email, you know, as a knowledge worker, that your biggest job is defining what your work is. So when you say new work, I say define what work is.
Yeah.
That's the new work, is defining what it is, because it doesn't show up. Emails don't tell you what to do with that email. And even if they do, you're going to disagree. Mail coming across into your physical mailbox doesn't tell you it's junk mail. Right. You actually have to think to decide what to do. But most people didn't figure out what the thinking algorithm was. I did. Because I said, what do I need to do to get this off my mind without having to finish it?
In the unlikely case that anyone is listening who's never heard the method, you quickly have to go through
what the method is, sure. Anything that's potentially meaningful, you can't finish the moment you think of it, you better capture it in some sort of trusted bucket externally. Sooner than later, you better decide exactly what it means to you. Is it actionable, yes or no? And if it is, decide what's the very next action I would need to take to move the needle on it. And if one action won't finish it, what's the project or the outcome I'm committed to complete that I need to keep track of until it's done? And then I need to organize the results of that in some sort of trusted system that I then can reflect and review what the contents are from the gestalt period with a clear head, and then make good trusted choices about what I do and what I don't do.
Perfect.
That's it.
So let's do it. Let's the podcast and let's get fixed. No.
That is it.
Oh yeah.
Sorry, I'm not going to tell you anything other than what I just told you.
But why is the book so long? I really, we're so honest.
I needed to create a filter to find out the people who were really going to get it.
Okay. I read it through, and I remember that you wrote, read it again, 6 months after you started the method, so I will read it again.
I had a guy write to me, I think he said he'd read the book 18 times. It's a different book every time you read it.
Wow. Yeah, that's cool.
Because I reduced this thing down to the essence of what defining work really is and what you need to do to get your attention off something.
Yeah.
And that won't change. In 2090, when we land on Jupiter, you still need an end basket. You still need to track stuff that you can't finish in the moment. You still need to decide the next actions and who's going to do it. You still need to have some sort of systematic way to be reminded of that so you see it at the right time and place. This won't change. You know, this is lean for the brain, as somebody called it. You know, it's like no waste in your head. But that won't change. But yeah, you're right. That's why we just came out with the Getting Things Done workbook for you.
I love the workbook. Right. I love the seminars.
Right. The workbook, it's just 10 steps, folks. You can get started with it. Because again, I just wrote it to write the manual. I didn't hold back. It's funny, Ken Blanchard was in a seminar of mine years ago, and he said, Dave, we came up at the end of the seminar. He said, David, you have 15 books in this seminar. Because Ken had a policy that he would never write a book you couldn't read on the plane from San Diego to San Francisco.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So that was all little mini things. And that's not what I wanted to do. I just needed to get this out of my head and get it all captured in case I got run over by a bus. You know, somebody at some point would figure this out. But I figured, meanwhile, let me write the manual. I'm not even a very good trainer. I'm a good presenter. But I don't have the patience to sit and hang with you guys if you're not going to get it right away.
But when you do,
that's why you have guys like Sabri.
I know. Thank you, Sabri. You and your team.
And his team. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
But when did you realize that it took off? Like after writing the book, and then because I remember there was like really the thing when everyone was talking about that method.
You know, I think it probably really. Well, it was a bestseller in the American market anyway. If you sell 50 or 60,000 in the year, they consider that a bestseller in the nonprofit or in the nonfiction world. Mm-hmm. And it did that. So
in
they
the
kept
first year.
in the first year, and they kept it in hardback. So they make more money that way instead of going right to paper. So they kept it in hardback for 2 years. Then they went to paper in 2003. Now it's the kind of book that I don't know if any of you in here noticed that, but when it's in paperback, you're willing to buy 15 for your staff, not in hardback. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely,
So what happened was that became a much more distributable, you know, kind of way to do it. And also that was when the blog world pretty much started. Mm-hmm. And people like Guy Kawasaki and Robert Scoble back then were big bloggers. And they became champions of my stuff. Yeah. So they sort of splatted me out there. And that's why it hit the tech world globally. Like in spades, right about then, and that's kind of what probably took it off. Certainly internationally, anyway. By that time, and by that time, I would think it was in 20 or 30 languages. So that was that kind of forced us to have to decide: do we try to scale this? You know, because frankly, Catherine and I, we're not big entrepreneurs. Frankly, that aspirational about all this. We're more researchers, and Catherine, by the way, has been my right hand for 30 years, with this work. So trying to figure out what do we then do with it, and we made the decision because the world was just knocking on our door. Not only that, there were a ton of GTD pirates out there. Everybody read the book, say, oh, I can be a GTD person, and they were just showing up with spades, and I didn't know how to build a global franchise network. I was just a bigger gum than I knew how to chew. So we just said, at some point, we better, let's take this thing global, see if we can scale it. We decided back then the only ways to do that, because I wasn't into having a big organization or managing a lot of people or a lot of stuff, was technology and partners. So then that's been a good long haul the last 10 or 15 years, I guess, that we've found really, really good partners that we could trust. And then we then certify master trainers and coaches in those markets, like these guys. So that kind of threw us into the global stage.
How many countries are you now?
Officially 73, I think we're represented in. But a lot of those are just small countries in somebody's region. Mm-hmm. There's not much going on there, but at least it's officially If you're in any one of those countries, you can look on our website and find whoever you could get trained by, you know, in the area or close by.
Now how many trainers do you have on a global scale, so roundabout?
I don't know. I think we have about 28 master trainers.
Wow.
See, we train master trainers who then have the capability of training people in their own regions and their own languages. All our master trainers are English speaking, and that's how we train them. And so our job is to keep supporting all of that. That's one of the reasons I'm here. And, you know, because hey, this guy and then Next Action Partners, they're our top licensee right now, just volume wise.
This is something I like from the US. I see a bit different. You guys are much better, and then okay, let's build a franchise around it. Let's scale it. Let's make it bigger. I mean, a lot of people have watched the McDonald's movie, The Founder, which is a great movie to watch. And you quickly mentioned there have been pirates, GDD pirates out there, because it seems simple when you like share the method. Yeah. It seems simple to say, oh, I do that as well. What's the thing that helped you to like get into these steps of franchising it and building an organization around it?
I don't know. I don't know. I didn't know how to do it. I mean, the guys who built the Franklin Covey Network and rolled out the Seven Habits around the world, David Covey, Stephen's son, and his partner, Stefan Martix, were co-COOs of Franklin Covey, and they jumped ship from Franklin Covey and created their own IP licensing business. And they were looking for boutique IP that wasn't global yet, that then they could use their technique and their network and their expertise in helping, you know, make it global. So they came to me and said, David, we could do this for you. So they're still doing it for us. So essentially, essentially Sabri really, and these guys really work for SM Covey, which is our IP license partner that then SM Covey then creates the relationship with all the licensees.
I didn't know that. That's very
did the work of Covey influence you? Was it a book you read more than one time, or is it?
I didn't read it more than once, but first things first, a great book. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't beat all that stuff, and you know, it's all good stuff. David Covey would stand up and tell you, if you really want to implement the Seven Habits, do GTD.
That's cool. This story we heard with Holacracy, the same thing. The Holacracy author and founder said, well, if I would have to choose between a company which has GTD implemented and no Holacracy, I would go for this country instead of one who will have Holacracy but not GTD. I mean,
yeah.
Well, how did this happen?
Well, Brian sort of got religion when he got GTD for himself. He was running a company at the time and just thought it totally changed his life. But then he said, how come I'm clear, but I walk into my company and it's not? So he said, how do we create organizational mind like water? Mm-hmm. Because I can be clear, you can be clear, but we get together, we have just now increased exponentially the potential complications and lack of clarity in terms of who's handling what. It is. So what Brian did, and did an extremely good job with it, was design, you know, what are all the things that, the behaviors that need to be set up and the processes that need to be set up so that, you know, I say, what has your attention? Holacracy calls it, what has the tension in the organization? It's the same thing. What is anybody noticing that needs to be noticed for whatever reason, good, bad, or indifferent? And then bring that to the surface, have a place to park it, have a process to be able to take it and put it into the system so it's resolved as fast as possible at as low a level in the organization as possible. Organizational sort of mind like water. So that's how it showed up. I was on the stage of Conscious Capitalism, it's an organization that sort of does, you know, supports, you know, cool companies doing, you know, doing that kind of stuff. And I was on the stage and Brian followed me on the stage. I'd not met him. And at that time, I'd made a bad call in terms of somebody I had hired to run my company, because I'm not the best player for that play. And didn't work out. So I was like, oh, that was really painful and expensive. And I said, okay, so I guess I have to figure out how to run the organization for myself. But I had a lot of smart, cool, you know, people. They did personal growth. We were transparent. We were loving people. We had dogs in the office. And, you know, come on, you know, how hip and cool could you be? And this is in California, you know, and yet that I said, can it ought to be able to organize itself. It doesn't need a CEO, it doesn't need somebody to be, you know, king and emperor and decide all that stuff and whatever. And then I heard Brian talk about Holacracy and what he'd come up with and what. And then I met him afterwards. He said, "Oh my God, you know, he's like the big fanboy." And so I said, "Ooh, so do not pass go, collect $100." I said, "I'm going to implement this," because I was going to close the company if I didn't have it do something that could take the pressure off me, because I was trying to write Making It All Work, my third book at the time, and I was up to here. And so, anyway.
So when was it? Which year was it when you implemented it?
2010 when I met Brian. 2011 is when when we implemented it, and we just jumped all in.
So can you share a bit about that process? Like, you made the decision instead of hiring someone to implement Holacracy.
Well, we hired the Holacracy One people to come in and just be consultants with us. So they worked very closely with us for a good 1 or 2 years, helping us implement the whole thing. And they did training. You know, they do a lot of training people internally how to do it. We had the whole company. We were about 50 people at that time. Go through their training and then understand all this. And, you know, kind of the funny paradox is I had to be a dictator to create a self-organizing organization. You will now do this. And so I just legislated it. Well, if you don't do it, I quit. So they didn't have much of a choice. So we just did it. We just jumped all in, which made it a lot easier to do. So
yeah.
You can't, it's kind of hard to do. I was talking to somebody earlier. It's kind of hard to do partially self-organizing because you have to deal with all the intersections with the people who aren't doing that. It gets real complicated.
And you're still working with Holacracy?
Yeah.
You did not change it?
No. No, but it helped us. You know, we moved from 50 people to 5. So, but it was all done holacratically. It was all done transparently. Everybody knew why. As soon as we found a great partner in the U.S. and Canada, we were trying to maintain delivering coaching and training in the U.S. and Canada. The SM Covey folks had set up an international license group. And so we were still trying to maintain all of that and working hard at it. But then we found a great partner that took that on. So it relieved us of all the overhead of having to try to manage both the training and coaching, you know, staff and, you know, selling all that and so forth. And we became kind of shrunk ourselves to an IP licensing company so that that's what we do. We still have digital products and the Connect online membership. But otherwise, and so everybody, you know, in the company were quite aware, totally transparent about the changes we were going to make, how to make it, and everybody was quite elegant, moving on to their own chapters.
Where did the initial decision come from to focus on that? Is it still something you influenced, or did it came through the?
Actually, yeah, it sort of came. I have to give credit to the guy who sort of was taking the role, if you were to say they were a CEO role, a guy named Mike Williams who, you know, came on when we implemented this, and Mike himself said, I need to get myself out of a job, David. You don't need me anymore. And so he felt somewhat obligated to him, and so I was a little shy to bring it up to even do that. And he was the one actually very smartly sort of framed this for us and said, you know, you're going to be a lot happier and healthier. And it turns out that was much more our strategy anyway, in terms of what we wanted to do. I mean, again, I'm still more of a researcher and an educator than an entrepreneur or aspirational person. So I can still, you know, produce IP. I'm still writing blogs and writing articles and essays. And this is my 2000th interview. You know,
wow.
So this one.
Yeah, you're doing episode 2000. We just.
Yeah, I was like, well, I don't know the exact number, but since the book came out, I have never stopped, at least, you know, 1 or 2 a week.
How many books did you sell so far? You know,
Getting Things Done is about probably 2 million.
Wow.
Yeah.
Very unlikely.
Nice benchmark.
Yeah, that's definitely.
Between the day the book came out and now it's almost 20 years, so what are the biggest changes you had to make with the method, or are there any changes? I mean, a lot of things happened on the technology side.
Not really. No, the methodology is still very solid. You know, when I wrote the revised edition in 2015, I changed some of the languaging. In English, we changed collect to capture. We changed process to clarify. We changed review to reflect. And we changed do to engage. So the subtlety of those words expanded this more to the deeper level that this stuff really hits. So it's not just a mechanical, you know, to put this stuff here. What you really do, capture is much bigger than just collecting things. Mm. It could be generating all kinds of creative ideas. It could be doing all kinds of stuff. And clarify really has a lot to do with how do I think about something and how do I creatively make a decision about it. So the word, there was some refinement in the wording, but the process was all the same. The biggest change was the audience. So it's because the first edition was really written for the fast track professional, because they were the ones that were getting hit, you know, in the late 90s with the tsunami of email and all that stuff. And they were the ripest audience, essentially, for what we did. So the publisher, Penguin, and just basically, and I decided, yeah, that's the market we need to go to. So it was called Getting Things Done. I'm on the cover. I'm in a suit and tie. And, you know, it was targeted to that group, really, of people. They were the hungriest, you know, for it. So rightly so. But we knew, I even knew back then, that it worked for students, it worked for stay-at-home dads, it worked for the clergy, it worked for physicians, it worked for anybody who had a busy life. But the new edition, I wanted to expand it, so a lot of the wording and a lot of the examples and so forth is a much more expanded audience. See, I would say maybe 30 years ago, 10% of your organization really needed this. Now, 95% of your organization
needs
it.
That's what I just wanted to ask in terms of like super distraction with many channels.
Yeah, and you know, the flattened organizations, nobody's got the time or interest to hold people's hands. They're expecting, you talk about new work, everybody's being expected to be their own entrepreneur, or entrepreneur anyway. You're going to manage yourself. Mm. You know, there's not the resources or interest of anybody to hold your hand very long, you know, about this stuff. So the necessity for people to kind of own their own game,
you know, I was one of these guys you mentioned. I did not know at this time that this book exists, so I probably had a better life meeting you 20 years before. But when I was turning 37, I got my first really big job. I was an agency, small consulting boutiques before, and then I became global CMO of Audi. And from day one, I got 200 emails with tons of PowerPoints, and I had a meeting schedule of 70 hours a week. I asked my team, how and when can I work? This is your work. And it needed 4 personal assistants, 2 to organize my schedule and 2 to help me to understand my job, and a big team. And I think it's exactly the right insight. At this time, everybody got crazy on this level. But I think now everybody's crazy on every level.
I mean, how did, to stress this point, like what you just said, everyone has a smartphone now, and the channels we have, they just expand every day. Yep. So there are much more channels. So in the life of a David Allen, who is a very public person, is GTD working every day with all the different channels?
Oh, sure. I mean, as we say, I eat my own dog food. So, guys, I have to do exactly the same thing everybody has to do, you know. And I just do it pretty quickly and pretty cleanly, but I fall off the wagon like anybody does. I mean, if you're not falling off the wagon with a little regularity, you may not be playing a big enough game. You know, so it's not about always being on the wagon. It's just knowing that there is a wagon, and when you fall off, realize you fell off and know how to get back on. So I'm getting back on my own wagon on a regular basis, several times a day. Because anytime you create a new vision or have some new thing you want to do or get promoted or get fired or any change happens, you're going to throw yourself out of your own comfort zone. You're going to have to reintegrate new data and recalibrate and refocus. That's just the name of the game. And so it's not about that you're always in some sartorial bliss. Nothing wrong with that, but you want to always be ready to get back to a clear head when it gets unclear again. So that's really kind of, in a way, all this methodology is really about is what do you need to do, and here's the big secret, folks. And I'm only telling you this because you've invited, this is obviously the best and brightest folks, you know, here in Germany and Berlin. So you get a special message. Getting things done is not so much about getting things done as it is about being appropriately engaged with your life, so you're present with whatever you're doing. Are you appropriately engaged with your cat? Are you appropriately engaged with your spouse? Are you appropriately engaged with your car? Are you appropriately engaged with your health? Are you appropriately engaged with your job? Are you appropriately engaged? See, and you don't have to go very far to see what you're not appropriately engaged with is what's got your attention. I'm curious, how many of you sitting here have had your mind go somewhere that has nothing to do with what we've been talking about while you've been sitting here? Anybody? Oh, come on, fess up. By the way, there's nothing wrong with that. I'm just saying what happened was something occurred to you that you have not yet made appropriate decision about, or you haven't parked the result somewhere that you trust you or the right person will see at the right time. So you don't have to go far to see where to apply this thing. Yeah. It's called what's on your mind? What do you need to do to get it off your mind? Now that assumes that you, like me, love clear space. It's up to you. Don't know how clear a space you want. But the biggest the biggest reason people won't have fully implemented GTD is their addiction to stress.
Because they love it.
You don't love it. Your willingness to tolerate ambient anxiety. You're willing to tolerate having a thought about needing tires on your car more than once. You're willing to tolerate thinking you need cat food more than once. You know, if I need cat food pops into your head twice, you're inappropriately engaged with your cat. Really? I mean, so what, you don't have to go far. I'll just say, well, wait a minute. Why is that still on your mind? Mm-hmm. What do you need to decide or do to get that off your mind? And it turns out that that's directly what you do that gets it done. You have to define what done means and what doing looks like and where it happens.
But isn't this why you change from do to engage in the process?
And because do has this, see, come on, productivity's got a lot of garbage or baggage around it. Productivity, oh God, I gotta work harder. Oh, they're gonna ask more of me. Oh my God, more stress, more stuff to do. But see, if you go to a party to boogie and you don't boogie, that's an unproductive party, right? Productivity just means produce something you wanna produce as an experience. Yeah. But productivity, so do had too much of stuff with it. Whereas the thing to do maybe to take a nap. You can't stop doing, by the way. This is a doing material world. You cannot stop doing. Try to stop doing and you'll try to do that. Right? So you can't stop, you're always doing something. That's why you're always working. And people say, I want to be productive. You already are productive. You're producing exactly what you got. Right? When you say more productive, you either mean I want to get what I'm getting out with less effort, or I want to put in the same effort and get more. So that's what being more productive is going to, you know, look or sound like. But everybody's already producing stuff. You're already doing stuff. You can't stop doing. That's why, you know, I call my third book Making It All Work. So in English, anyway, if you think about the double meaning of that, you make it all is work. Anything is work. Anything you want to get done that's not done yet is work. And people say, work. And even work has baggage to it in the English language anyway. But I say, but how about, hey, things really work. That's not a bad thing, right? So making it all work has the double entendre that, you know, that's why I put it there. So we're always all doing stuff anyway. It's just are you feeling really, really comfortable and clear with what you're doing? And that's the end game of GTD.
So for me, when I point out three things which really catch me, the first thing was this, to get everything out of your mind immediately. The second thing was to reduce the amount of channels which are putting things onto your table. So when Sabri and I worked on this, I ended up with 30-something
channels.
Yeah. Maybe a world record of GTD losers, but I reduced it significantly.
How many do you have now?
7, 8.
So like email, WhatsApp,
phone.
Well, you ask what's changed, especially in terms of technology. And I don't think there have been any significant changes in terms of technology and productivity since the word processor and the spreadsheet. Those were game changers. They changed how we work, how we thought, how we produced, how we created significantly. They really did. And, you know, relational databases and sort of all that stuff. What has changed significantly and is changing as I'm speaking is speed, connectivity, and volume.
Yeah.
That's what the technology has done. It's added channels, and it's added more things coming through those channels easier and a lot more speed to it. So, as I say, the only thing new is how frequently things are new, right? That's what's different, is how fast things are changing, that you're going to have to recalibrate, rethink, refocus what you're doing so you feel comfortable. I mean, how many times did your parents have to totally recalibrate their lives? You know, not nearly as many as you, I guarantee. You know, it's all coming toward us this year. You're going to probably have something happen that's going to totally reconfigure what you're doing, how you think about what you're doing. So that, and there's nothing new about that. Anybody got any of those kinds of changes gets their, you know, gets jangled and has to then refocus and resort, reorganize, and recalibrate. It's just that's happening so frequently now. That's one of the, that I think is one of the great advantages of GTD is it's giving people tools to deal with surprise.
Do you think that the next big invention, when you say the spreadsheet and the word processor were the big things, do you think that artificial intelligence has the chance to like make GDD work for me and make the decision for me so that I don't even have to go through the process, so that I wake up with a clear mind every morning saying, hey, Christoph, you have nothing to do to worry about today?
No, it's what my prediction and projection about all of this is all of that cool stuff that's happening. By the way, AI is only something that hasn't been implemented yet. If you don't think it's already working when you use your Google Maps or whatever, it's already out there.
Yeah,
I mean, this stuff is already, it's already functioning, it's already flowing. So what? So yay, well, that's really cool. What, it's not gonna decide what to buy your mom for her birthday. It's gonna give you a lot of cool options that you may have programmed in, but you're still gonna have to make the choice. So decision support is where the technology is going. It's helping you make better, more informed decisions, but you still have to make that decision.
I would disagree in terms of, let's say, video consumption and stuff that is not productive, let's say, but if there is an AI out there, let's take something as an example, like the YouTube feed or the TikTok feed or stuff like that, that is suggesting people what to consume. There is no decision made. And we're addicted to that consumption and thinking of like what to work on next, like getting to the office and then having something popping up and saying, this is the next thing.
So you believe out of the context where you're in, the AI could use the GTD system and could say, well, you're now in the car, Christoph, you could do the following 5 phone calls, or if you set it here.
I think that case is a bit linear in the way we think. That was not criticizing. But I was surprised, I was strongly surprised, and Michael has heard that before, in how, for example, TikTok is suggesting you videos. That's not an important app for us here in terms of productivity. That's what we think. But what happens in the background is quite tremendous, because this thing makes a decision on so many factors, and the decision is made for me, and it's extremely well and close to what I would choose anyways. And I'm just curious to think about
but you're still choosing.
Yeah, and it does not solve what kind of gift you do for your mother, but it tells you the best. Christoph, you're at the Tiffany shop and you know.
And I make the decisions.
Yeah, I mean, my ideal GTD app would be to walk in the room and it's Friday afternoon at 2 o'clock and it already knows it's Friday afternoon at 2 o'clock. And David, you usually like a beer at 2 o'clock on Friday afternoons, you know, yes or no, and I go reach up into the hologram, go boom, and the beer comes out of the fridge, right?
Something
like that. And my niece's birthday is coming up, and I see a hologram of my niece, and then I see all the things that I've tied to my niece in terms of people she knows, things she likes to do, her favorite colors, what I bought last year for her birthday, and all of that's available to me, and then I get to go move that around and go, I think I want that. Oh God, that tells me, oh, way cool. So I think there's a lot of creativity that the technology can help support and facilitate, but it's not even close yet to what I just said. I mean, it might be. I mean, who knows, as fast as these things, you know, kind of move, but I don't think I'll see that in my life.
But I think it will fit with GTD. When I step back to real life now and to the third thing, which I'm fascinated about, is the way you describe the next action, which is, if I compare this to my old to-do lists, where I after 1 week say, what is meant by this and this and that? So they really come from the end result, and you really write down what is the end result, and you will never, even if you have 3 weeks, I have to do this. This is magic. That's where the magic for me starts. And then number four is you have not lists for customers or topics or whatever, it's the context. I'm sitting in a car, I'm at home at my laptop, I'm in the bus, I'm whatever. And that's where I really started to, okay, now I can so much better arrange things which are now good to do.
Well, you're right. The next action concept is one of the most powerful. And very few people actually have it. It's a cognitive muscle you actually have to train yourself to get as granular as you need to about what the heck, that if I had nothing else to do but deal with this thing, where would I go right now? What specifically would I do? That's why most people's to-do list are incomplete list of unclear things that are producing as much stress as they relieve, because you look at it and you realize there's still decisions and thinking about since I haven't finished. I don't have the energy to think and decide right now. Stop reminding me I'm overwhelmed. Mm. You see stuff on to-do lists like mom, bank, you know, car, Joe. Yeah, right. Well, good. You captured something that has your attention. Why'd you write it down? Mom, historical data. You had one. Great. Why? Oh, her birthday's good. Well, what are you going to do about it? I don't know. And so if you haven't got it down to the very next visible, physical activity you would need to take if you were going to move on this commitment right now, you have not finished your thinking. Yeah. And with unfinished thinking, that's what's creating ambient anxiety that is spinning subliminally for most people at incredible levels. And again, that's back to the point of why people are not really fully implementing this, is most people are so used to it. It's like the last thing a fish notices is water. The last thing most people notice is the ambient anxiety they're in because they've been living in it. Wait till you taste what it's like to have absolutely nothing on your mind. It is a totally delicious place to operate from, and yet most people don't have that reference point. Or even if you did have that reference point once or twice, you didn't stay there long enough to make that your habit. See, I can't stay. If you said, David, hey, would you get back to me about that? It is habitual. I am reaching back here to pull this out and write that down. I can't stand to have that banging around in my head. That's an open loop.
So that's right. Your trusted system.
For capturing, absolutely. Yeah, because this is ubiquitously. I mean, I capture it other places if I'm sitting down, but that's with me everywhere. The plastic is with me.
And that makes GTD the method. I mean, 60% of the people have work-related anxieties, so these 60% are not GTD users yet.
Well, they may be to some degree. Here's another thing, folks. Look, this is not like running with scissors. There's nothing dangerous about any of this. If you just keep pen and paper by your bed, you'll sleep better. You know, if you just write down 10 more things this week than you would normally do, you're going to feel more in control and more focused. If you just decide one or two next actions on things that are kind of bugging you that you haven't decided yet, you're going to feel, wow, I'm in control of my life again. So you don't have to implement all of this to feel a lot better. If you want to have total clear space, yeah. See, you're going to be hard to justify halfway in between. Either your head is the place to hold stuff or it's not. And if any of you are managing calendars or diaries right now, you've already admitted your head can't do it.
Do you think, research shows that people are typically concentrate up to 1.5, 2 minutes. Some people say some are just concentrating for 7 seconds on things. Do you think that with GTD, you can expand this, that you really come into, if you really do important things, you come into flow, into a deep work?
Sure. Any of you ever watch a movie for 2 hours?
Yeah, it's possible, yeah.
Yeah, you weren't distracted after 7 seconds. You got engaged in what you were doing. And interestingly, you know, Csikszentmihalyi, the guy who did the flow stuff, his big surprise was as he was studying the flow state that you get into, you know, when time disappears and things are just clicking and you're in smooth flow and you're just on. He thought for sure that people would move most into the flow state when they were in their personal lives. Wrong answer. Turns out 85% of the time people are in flow, it's at work. Because that has the appropriate combination of just challenging enough that you're not bored, but not too challenging that you're feeling overwhelmed. And that's that place, you know, if you're rowing or if you're doing something or if you're doing any of those kind of activities. So being in a clear state so that you're just on with whatever you're doing, I think is available for whatever you're doing as soon as you're on. And it's a lot easier to be on if you're not distracted by anything. It's a lot easier to meditate, it's a lot easier to cook, it's a lot easier to listen to music. A lot easier to...
To focus on your partner.
Oh, yeah, I guess you could do that.
What's the stuff that you draw your inspiration from? Like, where do you get inspired?
Again, the still small voice. You know, I've got 50 years of meditating and, you know, working with a spiritual coach for all those years and being aware of other levels of stuff and having a lot of experiences on the other side. I just know I have a team, you know, that are not, you can't see them all, but they're all here, you know, like little stars on my shoulder. So they're around. So I just ask them, you know, and check out their advice, see if it works. So that, my partner, and, you know, Catherine keeps me honest, keeps me straight, keeps me inspired. My dog, you know, is very cute. And, you know, I pick up books every now and then that, you know, kind of turn me on to just different things.
What is one of the latest reads that you would recommend?
The latest read, I just read a deep biography of Erasmus. Since I'm an adopted Dutchman, I'm going to be that way. It's a fascinating guy, what he did. So that was my last read. My next read is in my hands right now. Catherine is just finishing reading it, called by Dan Levitin, who's actually a GTD-er friend of mine. He wrote The Organized Mind, and his brand new book is called Successful Aging.
Oh, wow.
And it's...
I will buy a copy.
Tons, at least according to Catherine. It's got tons of great research in there, and Dan's a great writer, about what we need to know about what happens to our minds and our bodies as we get, I'm getting 75 this year, so I go, kind of probably appropriate for me to kind of maybe see what's up, what's coming toward me.
Yeah. Christoph just told me with his fingers that we are over the hour. For me, it felt like 15 minutes, so I'm so happy, I'm so proud, and I want to thank you so much for doing this for us before we open the round.
Yes, wanted to ask, because you mentioned you like a drink or a beer on Friday, so yeah. It's Thursday now, but how about we sit at a bar, we can have a drink, and we open up the round for questions from the audience. Is that okay? Yeah.
Oh, totally fine. Yay.
Perfect.
So, yay, thanks, guys.
Thank you till here.
Yeah. Yay.
Thank you. Who wants to start?
Yeah.
We have a microphone for this.
Okay.
Too close.
This is awesome. Thank you. Hello, Dave. My name is Sebastian Street. First of all, thank you very much. I have not read your book, but I had heard your name, and I've researched and been to seminars, and I've done months with other people like Richard Bandler, completely different thing to you, but NLP. But the thing that really resonated with me, and you said it, hinted at it right at the beginning, and you came back to it, was you're talking about metaphysics, really. You're talking about the little voice. You're talking about channeling into a deeper truth. When you express laziness, it's because when you're on the right path, you don't really need to do anything. It just presents itself to you. And first of all, validates me. This is what you're talking about, right?
Yep.
On a deeper level. Even though I've not read your book, I'm guessing your book doesn't hint, it doesn't talk about that so much. It talks about pragmatic ways of dealing with this situation. But what was the first moment that in a meditative state that you let go of every thought, and what did that bring up for you?
I remember that I have two instances that I'll give you the answer to that. The first instance was when I had a friend who was a mentor. He was quite psychic, by the way. He was studied by the University of Pennsylvania about that stuff. And he was the guy who taught me karate. And
I have a second dan at Shotokan.
Say again?
I have a second dan at Shotokan. Like the whole way that you've been talking, Shotokan karate, like everything you're saying is exactly my life. It's very weird. Carry on. Sorry.
Okay.
Sorry,
and we had kind of a Damien sort of relationship, you know, in terms of that I was throwing the I Ching and running my life by, you know, the coins. And at some point, I was just sort of agonizing about something with him. And all of a sudden, I just said, oh, screw it. And I totally just let go of all that. And he said, that's a milestone. So I remember that point. That was a real, real point. And another one, which I think is interesting to share, was one of those freeway enlightening moments was driving on the freeway. I was up in Marin County somewhere, and it had one of those. And I was like, oh, what am I going to do with my life? What am I doing with my life? What am I going to do with my life? I want to make sure it's the right thing. I want to make sure it's all right. And the still small voice came in and said, David, you have created so much, not only in this lifetime, but in many more than you could ever count. You don't have to worry about creating anything. All you have to do is deal with what's in front of you with elegance and completion, and the next thing will automatically show up. And I haven't looked back since.
Wow, I love it. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, that's not in the book, by the way.
Don't keep it too close to the mouth, just.
First of all,
not too close to the mouth, like this, 10
like this, perfect.
Thanks a lot from my side as well, Monica. I cannot resist, so I have to ask you the question about, is there a difference between men and women getting things done, clearing their minds, and organizing their lives?
I have not experienced any in my 35 years of doing this work. There may be some that I just don't know about, but I have not.
Okay, good. I experienced some, but I assume that the method is different between yours and mine, so.
No difference. Well, everybody's different. Everybody's different in here in terms of what you do well, what you do easily, what's tough for you to do. Some people love detail and they're scared of taking risks and visioning. Some people love vision, blue sky, and they can't stand detail. So everybody's got sort of different personality traits and conditionings that I think that make parts of this easier than other parts. You know, a lot of people have a clean desk but a very disorganized mind. So it's hard to tell, you know, about any of that. And we've all probably got weak suits, you know, of some sort. In that degree, yeah.
One more question? Or beer?
Beer.
Beer.
Okay, so David, thank you so much. It was awesome. Thank you.
Yeah.